Well, I'm back. It was an interesting sermonette, and it's very interesting how some of these things blend together, because science and philosophy is what I'm going to begin with. Kind of interesting how that occurs. But how many of you have seen or know what a Newton's cradle is? I've got one right here. Now, when I pull it out of the bag, you're all going to know what it is. You've all played with one. You've all seen one. But it demonstrates the law of physics that I want to talk about today. And that's a Newton's cradle. So now, how many of you played with one of these? Yeah, most everybody. Just nobody knows what the name of it is. You know, Sir Isaac Newton developed these three basic laws of motion. And they go like this. His first law is anything that's currently in motion will tend to remain in motion. That's his first law. His second law is best explained as a formula: force equals mass times acceleration. And there's a lot of physics that go with that, but that's his second law. But his third law is best demonstrated by the Newton's cradle. That's why it's called the Newton's cradle. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And so when I pull back one ball on this thing, we all know what happens. We pull it back, and one ball is displaced on the other side because of the force of the first one. And you can have all kinds of fun with this thing. When you pull back two balls, isn't that interesting? Two balls are displaced. What do you think happens when I pull back three? Let's see. It rotates from side to side to equal out that force. You can have all kinds of fun with this. Pulling back four. What do you think four? That's pretty cool. You got to have one now, huh? So what happens when you pull back both? So that really does demonstrate very well that third principle that Newton discovered. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. But Newton didn't come up with these laws. He just simply discovered laws, physical laws, that God put in place during the creation. Cause and effect. Blessing and cursing. We can refer to this a number of different ways. For every choice, there is a consequence. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And whether the consequences are positive or negative, it really depends on the choice itself. So you can have some good choices and some wise choices, some positive consequences, or you could have some very poor choices and some very negative consequences. So that's what I want to talk about today. That's what I want to look at. If you like a title for the sermon, it's the choices that we make. The choices we make. God gave us the ability to choose. We heard that in the sermonette. The choices that we make can affect generations to come. It's kind of interesting, kind of scary, kind of spooky to think about sometimes. You know, there's a scripture that I'd like to start with, and it's very often quoted. But God tells our forefathers that he would like them to choose wisely. Let's begin by turning over to Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30, and I'd just like to set the stage by reading a scripture that we quote often in God's church. And in verse 15, he says, and I'm going to read this from the New Living Translation this morning. He says, "Now listen, today I'm giving you a choice between prosperity and disaster, between life and death. I've commanded you today to love the Lord your God, to keep his commands, his laws, regulations, by walking in his ways. If you do this, you will live and become a great nation. And the Lord your God will bless you and the land you're about to enter and occupy." Verse 17, "But if your hearts turn away and you refuse to listen, and if you're drawn away to serve and worship other gods, then I warn you now that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live a long and good life in the land you are crossing the Jordan to occupy." And verse 19, "Today I have given you the choice between life and death, between blessing and cursings. I call heaven and earth to witness the choice you make. Oh, that you would choose life, that you and your descendants may live. Choose to love the Lord your God and to obey him and commit yourself to him, for he is your life. Then you will live long in the land your Lord swore to give your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And even though this was mentioned to a physical nation so long ago, the spiritual principles apply to us today as well. You know, even the simplest choices that we make set us on a path. I've made a lot of choices in my life. You've made a lot of choices in your life. It's like I said, it's kind of interesting, it's kind of spooky to think about the simplest choices. Sharon and I grew up in a little suburb of northern Cincinnati, about two blocks apart from each other, and we met in high school, and we eventually married after I came back from college. What would my life be like if I hadn't gone to that football game where I met her? You know, that's kind of interesting to think about, because the answer is you have no idea what path your life would have been on. Did I make a good choice? Well, the real question is, did she make a good choice? Oh, she's nodding yes, so I guess I'm okay. I think she made an excellent choice. But would we be married to someone else? Maybe. Would we be happy? What about our sons? They wouldn't even be here. One of them could do something great someday. Or maybe their children, grandchildren, on down the line in generations. It's kind of interesting to think about. But none of them would have even been born. Another decision that I made, 21 years ago, I was offered a job in Oak Ridge. And although Sharon didn't really want to move away from Cincinnati, since all of our family is still in Cincinnati area, but I accepted the job, and we moved to the Knoxville area. What would my life had been like if we stayed in Cincinnati? Would we even be in God's church? I don't know. I wouldn't be standing here right now. I wouldn't know any of you. It's really interesting to think about the choices that we make. And, you know, the choice that we made to move is going to affect generations to come. My sons now have girlfriends from that area instead of that area. It's kind of interesting to think about. Their children are going to be born from women from that area instead of that area. It's really interesting to think about. We need to really think about the actions that we take, the choices that we make. Let's take a look at the first choice that was made in the Bible. And it really didn't go so well for them. Not really at all. But the lasting implications of that first choice is with us. And it affected all of mankind. Let's turn to Genesis 3. And take a look at what God said was the fate of that choice, the result of the choice that they made. Genesis 3 and verse 16. He says, to the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain shall you bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree which I command you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat of the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face, verse 19, he continues, you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, because you were taken out of it. For dust you are, and dust you shall return. And Adam called his wife Eve because she was the mother of all living. Also, for Adam and his wife, the Lord made tunics of skin and clothed them. Verse 22 is very interesting. Then the Lord said, behold, the man has become like one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him out of the garden to till the ground from which he was taken, and he drove out the man and placed cherubim at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the tree of life. That verse 22 is very interesting to me. Behold, the man has become as one of us. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary has this rendering of verse 22. It's very interesting, I thought. And God said, behold, the man has become one of us, and this is their commentary, not spoken in irony as generally supposed, but in deep compassion. The words should be rendered, behold, what has man by sin become, who was one of us, as one of us, formed at first in our image, no good and evil. How sad is his condition now? And now, lest he put forth his hand and take of the tree of life, this is the pledge of that immortal life, which obedience should be rewarded. Man lost all claim to this tree, and therefore he might not eat of it or delude himself with the idea that eating it would restore what he forfeited. So the Lord sent him from the garden. Pretty interesting commentary, I thought, on that verse. But the character of the man was changed. There was something that was lost. And eventually we know that man became more corrupt as time went on, and God destroyed most in a flood later on. It's kind of interesting to think about. When you think about that story, and you think about the choices, and you think about who trained Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve were trained, talked to by God himself. Taught personally, and they still made a poor choice. They still made that poor choice. You know, you might ask yourself, what chance do we have? But we have God's Spirit. We have some help. But, you know, maybe we shouldn't beat up on our children when they make poor choices. because they're going to make poor choices. You know, every parent starts out and they make all the decisions for their kids. And sadly, they get old enough to make their own decisions. But it would just be a lot easier if they just did what I told them to do. But we were talking to our son Jason last night, and he said, yeah, I made a lot of poor decisions. I've learned the hard way. And yeah, he's finally getting himself together. So I'm glad to see that. But they're allowed to make their own choices. When they get to a certain age, just like God allowed us to make our own choices. You know, we see in the pages of the Bible a lot of examples of good choices and bad choices. We're being held accountable at a much higher level to this day. We're being judged now with the knowledge that we have, with the understanding that we have. We, in a sense, have been offered that tree of life. And it really doesn't matter if you grew up in the church, like probably a lot of you did, or if you came in later, like my wife and I did. Even if you're not a baptized member in God's church, the knowledge and the understanding that you accumulate when you're here, you're accountable for that. So if you decide to turn away and then come back at a later date, you might have to live with those consequences. You might have to live with those choices that you made. And God will forgive you if you ask, if you repent. But the choices that you made while you were gone, you may have to live with those choices. You may have to live with those consequences. You don't have to turn here, but Christ said in Luke 12, verse 48, to everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. James also recorded in his book, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. And that applies to us as well. You know, the Bible is full of examples. Touch on a few of them. Moses was described as a friend of God. We see that in the Bible. But because of his actions, you remember, he struck the rock instead of talking to the rock. He wasn't allowed to enter into the promised land because of that choice, that decision. And he asked God three times. And finally, in Deuteronomy 3, God says, don't ask me about this matter anymore. You're not going. And that was the end of it. He had to live with that consequence, and he couldn't cross over. Many times, the actions that we see in the Bible and the actions that we take affect a lot of other people as well, not just your own personal consequences. David is used as an example in many sermons. And we all know the story of his adultery. We know the story of the murder with Uriah. But, you know, we might not think of the consequences that he paid. What were the consequences of those actions? You know, and certainly he was forgiven. We see that. We read that in Psalms 51 around Passover all the time, his prayer of forgiveness. But he paid a very high price for his actions, and God did not remove those consequences. The consequence was that his son died. Now, I used to think, well, what kind of penalty is that? You know, he does something like that and somebody else dies? Well, then I had children. That had to be worse on a daily basis to David, knowing that he was responsible for the death of his son. His actions, his choices, the consequences that he received affected someone else. That's got to be worse than dying yourself. However, it's interesting when you look at the Bible and you look at the choices that other people have made down through the centuries. David wouldn't have even existed without some choices that were made. So the choices of a man named Elimelech. Does anybody know who Elimelech is? It's a very interesting story that's in the book of Ruth. So if you start to turn over to the book of Ruth, I want to go through this story a little bit and see what these choices that these people made, the consequences of the choices, or the outcome of those choices, are kind of amazing. You know, the book of Ruth is a very amazing story of a woman who came out of paganism. And she made her choice to serve God. And as a result of her choice, she was grafted into a very special family. A very special family. Her lineage would produce one of the most beloved kings in all of Israel, King David. And eventually, her lineage produces the Messiah. It's quite a story. The book of Ruth is a book of choices. So many choices that were made. So many choices. Some of them were good. Some of them were not so good. Some of them were very wise. And some of them were very foolish. Let's begin by turning to Ruth. And let's look at verse 1. It came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab. He, his wife, and two sons. His name was Elimelech. His wife was Naomi, and the name of the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. And it's interesting that names, you know, a lot of times names actually point to the character of the person. Elimelech in this case means my God is great. And we'll see that, you know, I don't think he really believed that because of the choice that he made. Naomi means sweet. Now it's kind of interesting how that works out. Names, a lot of cases, point to the character of the individual. We named our first son Jason. And we didn't even know, we just liked the name. We didn't even know what it meant. And later on we found out that Jason in Hebrew means the healer. And that was kind of interesting because my wife had endometriosis. And it was very difficult for her to get pregnant. And guess what the outcome of pregnancy is. It heals endometriosis. So when we named him the healer, we just laughed about that because it was just interesting. My name means wealthy. In some ways I am. And I'm not rich by this country's view. But if you look at the world, look any of us, how any of us live. We're all wealthy. And we're wealthy with our spiritual knowledge as well. So it's kind of interesting. I'm no Bill Gates, but I'm not living in the mud over there either. So we're all pretty lucky. We're all very wealthy. But anyway, back to the story. We see in the introduction here that Naomi's husband makes this decision to pick up his family and leave. Now, he was a man of wealth. Elimelech was a man of wealth, and he was notable in the town of Bethlehem. Why he left isn't really recorded here. We're not told why. He just says he packed up and he left. He left with his wife and his two sons. Now, there is some speculation in history that he left because he was wealthy and he would be besieged by the other people that were affected more by the famine. But we're not known. It's just not known here. We're not told. All we're told is he packed up everything and moved to the land of Moab. So he made a choice, though. He made a choice to abandon his faith, his country, and move into a pagan land of Moab. And verse 2 concludes and says, and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. And then a rather striking turn of events occurred. And we're just given a summary here because it just goes by so quickly. It says, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Now, we don't know exactly why he died, what happened. We're not told. We're just told he died. And in verse 4, we're told that the two sons took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. So what we're told there is after the husband's death, the two sons meet women of this pagan culture. They're in Moab. What choice do they have? So they marry. They marry outside the faith and into this pagan culture. They marry women from this pagan culture. So they made choices. And for 10 years, we're told here that they were married to these women, but for some reason there were no children. We're told that they were both barren, no children, for 10 years. And then in verse 5, another summary here, another summary statement. Both Mahlon and Chilion died. So the woman, Naomi, survived her two sons and her husband. And we're not told what happened to them either. Were they afflicted by some disease? Were they killed by Moabites who didn't like them? We just don't know. We're just told that they died. And in verse 6, then she arose with her daughter-in-law, that's Naomi, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. So she had heard that the famine had lifted and it was time to go back. She wanted to go back. And what was there to stay for anyway? Her husband was dead. The two sons were dead. There's nothing to stay for. So she decides it's time to return. Choices. All of these are choices that were made. So we see in verse 7 that she heads out with both of her daughters-in-law. And in verse 7, therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughter-in-laws with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But, you know, she must have thought about that on the way, because you see here that she changed her mind. Maybe she thought that two Moab women wouldn't be very welcome in Judah. I'm not really sure, but she changes her mind in verse 8 here, and she tells her two daughters-in-law, go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And the Lord grant that you will find rest, each in your house of your husband. And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. So initially, both of them resisted and said, no, we want to go with you. But in verse 10, she said, surely we will return with you, both of them said this, to your people. But she reasons with them a second time in verse 11, and she says, no. She says, turn back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husband? Well, why did she say that? Well, there was a law back in those days known as the Levirate Law that said if the son died, the next son in line needed to marry. But she's saying, I don't have any sons left. I don't have any sons. And in verse 12, she expounds on that, and she says, turn back, my daughters, I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope to have a husband tonight, to bear sons, would you wait for them until they're grown? Would you restrain yourself from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. So Naomi decides that because of what happened to her, God wasn't happy with her. You know, her husband died, her two sons died. She's having a hard time now. She was wealthy when they left, and now they're very poor. And so she's going back home. Verse 14. And this is both of them lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Now that's kind of a difference right there. What does that mean? One kissed her and one clung to her. It's an interesting verse. And it's also the last time that Orpah is mentioned in the scriptures. But if you read that from the New Living Translation, it makes it a little bit plainer. This is verse 14 from the New Living Translation. But again, they wept together, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth insisted on staying with Naomi. So that's what the verse means. One was going to take the advice and leave. But the other one made a different choice. They both made a choice. Orpah decided to go back to her people. But Ruth insisted on going with her mother-in-law to a strange land where, quite frankly, she probably wasn't going to be treated very well. And they knew that. So Orpah made an easy choice. On one hand, in one sense, you could say that. And Ruth made a difficult, a more harder choice. Orpah's not mentioned in the scriptures again. But history shows that after making her decision, she went back and she found a husband. She finally did find a husband. She went through a pretty tough time before that because the land of Moab was a pretty promiscuous place. And she was part of that quite a bit. I won't go into the details because they're kind of gory, actually. But she finally did find a husband, a delegation of soldiers from the armies of the Philistines came through, and she fell in love with one of them, history records. And one of her great-great-grandsons does make it back into the scriptures. We'll explain that later. But there's some speculation in history that this great-great-grandson of Orpah's was actually from her promiscuous past, and not her marriage, but that's neither here nor there. That's a different story altogether. But she does have someone that comes back into the scriptures. It's kind of an interesting story. So let's continue with the story. As I said, Orpah made one decision, but Ruth wants to continue. So Naomi takes one more chance, one more shot at talking her into it in verse 15, to going back. And she says in verse 15, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. And then we have verse 16 and 17, which are probably some of the most beloved scriptures read by multiple religions. And it's found in a lot of different marriage ceremonies, even to this day. Verse 16, a remarkable response, Ruth says, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I'll go, and wherever you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything, but death parts you and me. Till death do us part, she says. And verse 18 ends that section and says, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. With a remarkable story of dedication and loyalty. So we see in the following verses that she did return to Bethlehem with Ruth, but she was hardly recognizable. In the following verses, they say, is this Naomi? This person that's coming back? Didn't she leave with her husband, two strapping sons? And now who's this? Is this really Naomi? Who's this girl that he comes back with? Well, I wanted to take some time going through chapter 1 to give the background of the choices that were made here. But I want to skip ahead. We know from chapter 2 that Ruth ends up gleaning the field of Boaz, who is Elimelech's relative. And we see in chapter 3, verse 9, that Naomi sends Boaz to marry, or sends Ruth to marry Boaz, because she thinks he's the redeemer. He's the closest relative, according to that Levirate law that I talked about before. But we see there's a snag in the plan. We see in chapter 4 that Boaz was not the closest relative. We see that there was a closer relative. And this person's not named. But I'd like to pick up the story in chapter 4, and I'd like to read it from the New Living Translation because I think it's rather amusing the way that it's translated in the New Living Translation about the reaction of this closest relative. It's pretty amusing to me. In verse 2, let's pick it up there. Boaz called 10 leaders from the town and asked them to sit as witnesses. And Boaz said to the family redeemer, that closer relative that I was talking about, you know Naomi, who came back from Moab. She's selling land that belonged to our relative, Elimelech. And I felt that I should speak to you about it so that you can redeem it if you wish. If you want the land, Boaz tells him, then buy it here in the presence of these witnesses. But if you don't want it, let me know right away, because I'm next in line to redeem it. And the man says, I'll buy it. It's mine. I'll take it. Boy, I can add to my riches. You know, his land, he was wealthy, remember? A man of notable in the Bethlehem. He's got some good land. I'll take that land. That's my land. Then Boaz said in verse 5, of course, your purchase of the land from Naomi requires that you marry Ruth, that Moabite woman. And that way she can have children who'll carry on her husband's name and keep the land and the family. Now, according to that law, that land, any children that he produced with Ruth would have his name, not the other name. The land would stay in Naomi's family and wouldn't go to him. So he thinks about that for a minute. He says, no profit. And in verse 6 he says, I can't redeem it. I don't want it. I don't think so. And then he gives a reason why. He even says, he's worried about his own wealth. He says, this might endanger my own estate. You redeem the land. I can't do it. So we see in verse 10 that Boaz does redeem the land. He takes Ruth as his wife. And in verse 13, this is still the New Living Translation, so Boaz marries Ruth and took her home to live with him. And when he slept with her, the Lord enabled her to become pregnant, and she gave birth to a son. Now remember, she was barren for 10 years with this other guy. kind of interesting. In verse 14, the women of the town said to Naomi, "Praise the Lord who has given you a family redeemer today. May he be famous in Israel." And he was quite famous. He did become quite famous, not only in Israel, but in all the world. Because we see in verse 21, Salmon was the father of Boaz. Boaz was the father of Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David. Kind of incredible how those choices, think about those choices that she made, led to the most beloved king. But there's more. There's more than that. Because if you turn over to Matthew 1, you don't need to turn there, I'll just read it real quick. But Matthew 1 gives lineage as well. And it picks up in verse 5, the same place Ruth left off. It says Solomon was the father of Boaz, but it gives some more information. Guess who the mother was? Rahab. Rahab? The harlot? Yes, Rahab the harlot. Boaz's mother was Rahab the harlot. Interesting. And Boaz was the father of Obed, and his mother was Ruth. Ruth of Moab. We have a harlot and a Moab, a pagan person. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of King David. It says in verse 6. But there's even more to the story there, because in verse 16, several more generations later, Jacob was the father of Joseph, who was the husband of Mary. Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is the Messiah. Now that's famous. Pretty good choice. Pretty good choice that they made. That's pretty famous. What about Orpah? Remember I said that Orpah made a different choice and she went back. And as history shows, she did find a husband from the soldiers of the Philistines. And she had a famous great-great-grandson, and we all know his name. Because, as history has it, the great-great-grandson of Orpah met the great-great-grandson of Ruth on the battlefield. The great-great-grandson of Orpah was Goliath. Very interesting history. Consequences of choices. Very interesting. Very interesting. Let's see. Let me check the time. Don't want to go over. Looks like I'm okay. I can go on to another example. But the example of Ruth is very striking, I believe. The choices and their consequences. Let's look at another example in the Bible that also changed all of history. And it's the story of Jacob and Esau that we're very familiar with. But let's look at it from a different perspective, because I think this is very interesting, the choices that were made. If we pick up the story in Genesis 27, we see Jacob and his mother are set for deception. They want to deceive. Now it came to pass, it says in verse 1, when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he couldn't see, that he called Esau, his older son, and he said to him, "My son," and he answered him and said, "Here I am." And you know the story. He sent Esau out to kill some venison, to kill some meat and bring it back. But, you know, Rebekah overhears what he is saying to Esau. And so while Esau's gone, she concocts this plan to deceive her own husband. So she tells Jacob what to do, how to dress. You know the story. He put those coats on. And in verse 18, he went in and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am." "Who are you, my son?" he says in verse 18. And Jacob says, "I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done just as you told me. Arise, sit and eat of the game, that your soul can bless me." Well, you know, that was a lie. No other way to look at it. He lied to his father. Isaac said to his son in verse 20, "How did you find that so quick? You know, that was pretty quick. You went out there. How did you find that so quickly, my son?" And then he says, "Because the Lord your God brought it to me." Another lie. But now he brings God into the picture. It's not bad enough lying, but he says, "Well, God did this and God did that." Interesting. And now down in verse 24, you know, he says, "Wait a minute, you know, this is the voice of Jacob, but you got the hands of Esau. I don't know." He says in verse 24, "Are you really my son Esau?" You know, he lied three times to his father. Three times. And you know the story. When Esau found out, he was very angry. Jacob had to flee. And I think it's more than coincidence, because of the actions, the choices, and the decisions that he made. A couple of chapters later, we find that his father-in-law lied to him. Very interesting. Very interesting. Genesis 29, verse 25. If you're in Genesis, you can pick up the story. Genesis 29, verse 25. "So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah, not Rachel." Wait a minute. What happened here? I was supposed to marry Rachel. "Then he said to Laban, 'What did you do to me? Wasn't it Rachel that I served you for? Why have you deceived me?'" Deceived, the interesting word he used. It is there after deceiving Isaac the way he did. "And Laban said, 'It must not be done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn.'" Well, you know, that's information he could have told him ahead of time. You know, it would have been nice to know. "So fulfill her week, and I'll give you this one also for the service which you will serve me yet another 7 years. Now, it's interesting that he deceived his father, who was blind and couldn't see. And he was deceived when he couldn't see that it was Leah and not Rachel. You think maybe he thought about that for 7 years when he was working? Wow, I got my just dessert there, didn't I? I deceived my father. I had to run to this land, and now I get deceived. I think maybe he thought about that. And then another thing that he had to watch, which was interesting, because Reuben, his firstborn, lost the birthright as well. He committed adultery with his father's concubine, and we see the story there. He probably watched in horror, knowing the series of events that he put into place. The birthright went to Joseph, Rachel's firstborn. And the implications are with us to this very day. And to add insult to injury, the ancestors of Reuben sold a great part of the United States to the ancestors of him, making the United States one of the greatest countries that have ever been. That's insult to injury generations later. Generations later. And it's interesting that Reuben and Joseph were both tested the same way. Reuben failed the test. He failed that test. And you know that Joseph didn't. He didn't commit adultery with Potiphar's wife. As a matter of fact, he said in verse 9, "There's no one greater in this house than I. It is kept back to anything from me but you. Because you are his wife, how can I do this wickedness and sin against God?" That was his response when Reuben did the other. It's interesting, the choices that we make, the lasting effects that they have. You know, God is in the process and in the business of building character with all of us. And he has begun this process through the people that he has chosen throughout history. And he's continuing that today with us. The choices that we make can affect future generations profoundly and can affect our own lives, as we saw in examples here today. Cause and effect. Blessing and cursing. Sir Isaac Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Newton's cradle has that law built into it. But I hope we have that law built into our minds through the Holy Spirit.